Thank you very much.
In late September 2025, President Trump approached a podium in the Roosevelt Room at the White House.
Today, we're delighted to be joined by America's top medical and public health professionals as we announce historic steps to confront the crisis of autism. Horrible, horrible crisis. I want to thank the
Trump was flanked by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. and several other people representing agencies involved in creating federal health policy, and the president was ready to do just that.
First, effective immediately, the FDA will be notifying physicians that the use of acetaminophen. Is that okay? Yes. Which is basically commonly known as Tylenol during pregnancy can be associated with a very increased risk of autism. So taking Tylenol is not good. All right, I'll say it. It's not good.
This news conference seemed to be an attempt to keep a promise made by Kennedy back in April to find the cause of autism by September.
For this reason, they are strongly recommending that women limit Tylenol use during pregnancy unless medically necessary. That's, for instance, in cases of extremely high fever, that you feel you can't tough it out, you can't do it. I guess there's that.
Targeting Tylenol as a potential cause of autism was an unexpected turn that appeared to be grounded on one meta-analysis, a study of studies, that claimed to find an association between Tylenol use during pregnancy and the development of autism in children. The review did not claim that Tylenol causes autism, just that the studies in that review suggested there might be an association. So correlation, not causation.
You know, the way I look at it, don't take it. Don't take it. There's no downside in not taking it.
Is that true, though? Are there no downsides to not taking the fever reducer and painkiller during pregnancy? And is the upside the potential end of autism, or at least a sharp decline in cases? And for kids right now who are on the autism spectrum?
We've learned some pretty good things about certain elements of genius that can be given to a baby, and the baby can get better.
Wait, is that also true? Is there an effective treatment for autism that we're only now hearing about? We asked a pediatrician who specializes in neurodevelopmental disorders what she thinks about all this. What did she say? From Texas Public Radio, this is Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri.
Support for Petri Dish is made possible by UT Health San Antonio's Mays Cancer Center, South Texas NCI-designated cancer center, providing cancer care for patients, advancing research, and educating the next generation of leaders. Mays Cancer Center is working to end cancer in South Texas and beyond. Learn more at mayscancercenter.org.
The meteoric rise in autism is among the most alarming public health developments in history. There's never been anything like this. Just a few decades
President
ago,
Trump started his briefing with some sobering statistics.
It used to be 1 in 20,000, then 1 in 10,000, and I would say that's probably 18 years ago. And now it's 1 in 31. But in some areas, it's much worse than that, if you can believe it. 1 in 31. And I gave numbers yesterday. For boys, it's 1 in 12.
That's alarming for sure, and it is essential to understand what's driving such a sharp increase in cases. So I reached out to the largest professional organization of pediatricians in the United States, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it connected me with a specialist in Austin.
My name is Noon Tran. I am a developmental behavioral pediatrician, which is a subspecialty of pediatrics that focus on the evaluation and management of children with developmental behavioral differences. I've been practicing for about 23 plus years or so in this field. So seen quite a bit of evolution regarding better diagnostics and recognition. So certainly there's been some definite improvements over that time, but some definite challenges, especially in an area that has a really big knowledge gap between what we know and what we don't know. Whenever there's a huge difference in that knowledge gap, people like to fill it.
Yeah, they do. Okay, so Dr. Tran, let's start with the basics of what we do know. What is autism?
The features we see clinically are impaired socialization. That includes difficulty with communication. And so not language, not grammar and vocabulary, but your ability to both verbally and non-verbally communicate. Your ability to establish typical relationships or interactions with others, not just interactions with unfamiliar persons, but also familiar. And then the other one is what we call reciprocal. So it impairs back and forth interactions and impairs your use of communication in those back and forth interactions. And your ability to establish relationships both with unfamiliar and familiar persons because of the impaired back and forth. You have to have all three components.
So that's what autism is. It's a collection of symptoms that can include differences in thinking, communication, both spoken and nonverbal, social skills, repetitive behaviors. There's no blood test or anything like that that you could get that will tell you with certainty, yes, this is autism, because it's not just one thing with one cause. It has many different representations, likely many different causes. And over my lifetime, the number of people who have been diagnosed with this particular neurodevelopmental disorder has just skyrocketed. The president is definitely right about that. So, Dr. Tran, what is going on here?
Oh, yeah. So we know there's multiple reasons, and there may be environmental factors. I'm not going to discount this, but we know that there's other reasons for the increase. Better recognition. You know, 20 years ago, if I said the word autism to a family, tears in everyone's eyes. Parents had to go walk to the library to look at what autism was. And pediatricians like, what is autism? They weren't even screening for autism at the time. And so they had to wait until the child became so classically autistic before they referred.
Right. So kids with what we used to call classical autism have significant challenges in speech, communication, and other autism symptoms. We now call them kids with high support needs. They need a lot of help, right? They are on one end of the autism spectrum. Over the last 20 years, we've gotten much better at recognizing kids who are elsewhere on the spectrum.
So better recognition means more screening tools. More screening tools means early identification. The internet and the accessibility of information means the parents were the first ones to bring it up before the pediatrician. So better recognition and what we call diagnostic substitution. So back in the day, before we would say autism, these kids would be more likely diagnosed with intellectual disability, which we know is a comorbidity of autism and not autism. So it's diagnostic substitution. So the prevalence of intellectual disability went down and autism went up. If you go even further back, these kids who had a lot more behavioral problems and less of the social communication problems would be labeled more psychiatric labels, schizophrenia, mood, anxiety, or any combination, personality disorders, whatever it may be. And so now that we had defined it better, it's like, oh, okay. The construct of their disability is better said autism than schizophrenia.
All right, so we've got diagnostic substitution, more widespread recognition from both pediatricians and parents.
and identification of milder cases. And so we would only be able to detect some of the more moderate, severe cases, but we're detecting, it's like, you know what, now that we know what the phenotype is, I see this phenotype in even milder patterns. And that's how we advance science. We launch a clinical picture, we get better and better and better and better, better clinically. So that helps us drive research. Because autism is so heterogeneous, that's why it's going in so many different directions.
So where is science on potential causes?
We actually have already clocked in 200 plus known areas of the genome that, when abnormal, create some combination of socialization, communication, and repetitive restrictive behaviors, and each have their own signature. That's why it's so heterogeneous. So the spectrum is because there's more than one cause. About 25 to 30% of cases of autism, we have identified the cause, and they fall predominantly genetic in that 200 plus.
And so the $1 million question is, where does Tylenol fit in here?
Acetaminophen, the way it works in the human body, it just has no bearing on the pathway of autism. And so, in fact, fever in pregnancy is actually way worse. So actually, the reason we give it is because we know internal maternal temperature disrupts embryogenesis. And so we want to treat that. So the risk of fever and neurodevelopmental outcomes is far, 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 far higher than any risk that comes with Tylenol, and especially when they're trying to link it to autism. It just has no pathophysiologic sense. So that's why for us, it's just never been on the table as a consideration.
What about the idea that there is no downside to not taking it, right? So maybe skip it if you're just having a little pain, you know, tough it out, as the president said.
I think actually women have already done that. I think most women do avoid things at all costs during their pregnancy if they could. And so that's already probably a given. And so I think in general, that's what we advise women a lot of times. Like if it's something where a back rub can do, or like a cold compress, I think we often advise women to do. But if they're having something serious as fever or severe pain, there's just no evidence to suggest they should avoid it. So especially for fever.
It's been a long time, but if I remember correctly, you're not supposed to do anything that really makes you too warm during pregnancy, right? Like even saunas or anything that could raise your core temperature.
Especially during earlier embryogenesis, it's just one of those things that we want to avoid. The mom isn't herself an incubator, so we don't want the incubator to be turned up.
Guess what? Tylenol wasn't the only target for President Trump in September.
They pump so much stuff into those beautiful little babies. It's a disgrace. It looks like they're pumping into a horse.
We'll have more on that and the vitamin that Trump says might make autistic children better when Petri Dish continues.
Support for TPR comes from the University of Texas at San Antonio's Brain Health Consortium, a pioneering research hub advancing neuroscience, neuroengineering, precision medicine, and more. Learn more at utsa.edu/BHC.
TPR tells the stories of our city, our struggles, and our triumphs. Leaving a legacy gift to Texas Public Radio helps keep those stories alive. Find out how to create your legacy at tpr.org/legacy.
Welcome back to Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri. President Trump seems to have strong feelings about the U.S. vaccine schedule.
You have a little child, little fragile child, and you get a vat of 80 different vaccines, I guess, 80 different blends, and they pump it in.
Clearly, the president and I have different pediatricians. My daughter is a fully vaccinated adult now. She got all the recommended vaccines, which includes protection against 15 different diseases in around 30 vaccine doses over the first 18 years of life. There was no VAT, and there were several doctor's visits over the years. Now, the number of doses can increase to more than 50 if your child gets, you know, COVID and flu shots every year, but those are optional. One of those vaccines that is typically not optional before your kids can go to public school is the two-dose MMR, which protects against measles, mumps, and rubella. The president is not a fan.
The MMR, I think, should be taken separately. This is based on what I feel, the mumps, measles, and the three should be taken separately. And it seems to be that when you mix them, there could be a problem. So there's no downside in taking them separately. In fact, they think it's better. So let it be separate.
Well, there is actually a small downside to taking them separately. No companies actually make just a measles vaccine or a mumps vaccine or a rubella vaccine. There's just the combined MMR. We've been talking to developmental behavioral pediatrician Dr. Noon Tran. So, Dr. Tran, what do pediatricians say to parents who come in asking for these vaccines separately?
We'll say, in our most loving way, there's no such thing. The most common, actually, request is, could we delay the MMR? It's like, well, talk to me, tell me what your reservations are. How are you seeing this vaccine? What are you thinking? And we will come up with a good game plan that you feel good about. If they say, I just want to delay it to the second year, okay. But in the meantime, watch that surveillance data. Really pay attention to it. If you see someone, where's your mask? Do not be anti-mask at this point. It's a trade-off. Make everyone who comes in the house wear a mask. And so we really want to make sure that you make a smart decision. And so when we partner with families, we're good. We're good because most families are not truly anti-vax. They are just trying to absorb so much information and they don't know what to make sense of it. And so I say partner with your trusted people and make a good sound decision for your family. And so that's the best way to go.
One of the reasons the MMR became a suspect in the search for what causes autism is that the first dose is given at around the child's first birthday, and some parents of autistic children have noted that their child, who they believed had been developing typically, hitting milestones and that kind of thing, had been acquiring skills, began to lose them after getting the MMR. They began to regress. What's going on with that, Dr. Tran?
So there's going to be a cohort of kids who are trucking along and suddenly regress. Usually it's not truly 100% regress because they still walk on time. Every part of other their body, except whatever the gene was driving, which in this case, those genes that code for something in the neurons that are going to be in the socialization, communication, and behavior world. And so we just know that there's something that was going along and then whatever was driving it just suddenly made them pause. And so it looks like regression. They probably still have those words, but it's in the brain. They no longer express it. That's the socialization part.
All right, so let's drill down on this a little bit more because it even took me a while to understand it, and it's my whole job. So kids whose parents report that they develop autism when they're toddlers, they've been babbling and talking and making eye contact, then stop. These kids may not actually be losing these skills.
Right, so when the kids are regressing, it's sort of a pause in development. I have the word still, but I no longer use it for social purposes. I used to make eye contact for social purposes, but now the genes that are implicated in my condition, I no longer use eye contact for social purposes. I use it for vision. I use it for watching TV. I use it for looking for things in the environment, but I don't use it for social purposes, right? And so you don't lose your vision. You're using your use of your vision for social purposes. You don't necessarily lose language. A lot of parents will say they still follow directions. So they know, like, go give it to your mom, and they might hand it to the mom, but yet they stop saying mom because they no longer use language for communication, which is a social purpose of language. And so that's the phenomenon of regression.
And Dr. Trant says this may happen because whatever gene isn't working in the typical way, it can take a couple of years for, say, a toxic metabolite to build up enough to start damaging neurons that control socialization, communication, and behavior. But when that metabolite reaches critical mass, so at around age 2, that's when these parents start seeing their kids losing the ability to communicate with words they likely still know. They might also stop making eye contact, even though their eyes still work perfectly well. So the fact that it seems to happen after these kids get the first dose of the MMR vaccine may be another example of correlation, not causation.
Exactly. Whenever a family talks about the MMR, we cite this study called the First Birthday Video Study. So we asked families who swore to God that their autism started after their MMR vaccines and say, send us your first birthday video before they got the vaccine. And so they had psychologists who are experienced in autism look at control birthday videos where the child had no autism. And we had the children who have autism and look at the first birthday video. And son of a gun, they already can tell at their first birthday prior to vaccination who had autism and who didn't. And so that tells you that it's way before. And so way before. And families who actually have a second child without autism, I'll ask them that question. By the way, now that you have two kids, one with autism, one without, did you see now something different? Like, oh man, I can tell. And so then now they can see the difference. So we know that the neurodevelopmental differences, because remember, it's about core socialization and core communication, that those deficits were well before 1 year old.
Okay, let's turn our attention to the medicine.
The FDA will be updating the label of an existing drug to reflect potential benefits in reducing some autism symptoms. This gives hope to the many parents with autistic children that it may be possible to improve their lives.
So President Trump there is talking about a vitamin B9. You may know it as folate or folic acid, but he's talking about a specific type of B9, folinic acid. When you get it by prescription, it's called leucovorin. But before we explore folinic acid as a potential treatment for autism, let's talk about what happens when you don't get enough folate. Can it cause autism?
So when you have systemic folate deficiency, we know it creates anemia, ulcers, GI problems. We know what that looks like, and it doesn't include autism. And we know what cerebral folate deficiency looks like, big seizures, neuropsychiatric problems, and maybe autism. And if there's atypical psychiatric features with seizures, we would think, should we be considering folate deficiency more so than when we think autism? Because if it was folate deficiency causing autism, it would cause a whole host of other problems. It just can't be by itself.
Cerebral folate deficiency is what the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert Kennedy Jr., talked about at the president's news conference, and the head of the FDA has approved an old name brand version of leucovorin for this new use to treat cerebral folate deficiency.
So if you have systemic folate deficiency, that means that your whole body is deficient. Then you automatically have cerebral folate deficiency. So it's an automatic. Okay. Now, the question is, what about the ones that just have cerebral folate deficiency, meaning that your systemic is okay, but you don't have it in your brain?
This could happen for a couple of reasons. You might have a problem absorbing folate, or you might have a genetic variation that prevents B9 from getting into your brain. You might have heard that mutations on a gene called MTHFR cause folate deficiency. This gene makes an enzyme that converts folate into a form that your cells can easily use. Now, if you have a couple of well-known variants on the MTHFR gene, and a lot of people do, they're very common, your ability to make that enzyme could be reduced.
But it doesn't go down to zero. It reduces by a certain percentage. Just make sure that you have a good amount in your diet and maybe a little bit more supplement, but it doesn't cause the kind of folate deficiency, especially cerebral folate deficiency, that we worry about too much. But if you do have that variation, folinic acid doesn't require this enzyme, and so it's probably the more preferred form. If you have the MTHFR gene variation.
I have MTHFR variants, and I have taken folinic acid purchased over the counter. Kennedy is recommending vitamin B9 as prescription leucovorin.
So it goes back to the idea that folate deficiency causes autism. It's like, well, and cerebral deficiency, these kids don't have autism alone. They have major neuropsychiatric problem and seizures. So when parents say, can you prescribe leucovorin? It's like, well, clinically, there's no reason to, because they don't have any of the other symptoms that would go with systemic or cerebral folate deficiency.
But again, it can't hurt, right?
So let's say I prescribe leucovorin to every patient. It's probably not going to be a high-risk situation. It's going to be more the emotional toll, the false hope for families, when the folate has nothing to do with the child's pathogenesis of their autism, right? So that's the issue. Is folate in the pathogenesis of autism? The answer is the majority is going to be no. Is folate a contributor to overall health? The answer is yes. And so a lot of these kids will improve just because their folate levels improve, but not curative.
So it's interesting to me there that you brought up false hope, because the president is framing it in terms of bringing new hope to parents in this situation.
I'm not saying they should lose hope. I'm worried about false hope.
So for me, as a mom, if there was a part of that news conference that sort of bothered me, it was the part that seemed to imply that people who have taken Tylenol while pregnant did it because they're just, you know, weak and willing to put their own comfort ahead of their baby's health.
If you can't tough it out, if you can't do it, that's what you're going to have to do. You'll take a Tylenol, but it'll be very sparingly.
He's giving this impression, whether he means to or not, that folks are just sort of gobbling up a bunch of Tylenol at the first hint of discomfort, and that's why we're seeing more autism cases. So, Dr. Tran, do you feel like this whole thing sort of places blame for autism squarely on parents' choices, specifically moms?
Oh, yeah, so absolutely, because you took the acetaminophen. And you didn't have enough folate and you didn't do enough research. 100%. Moms already do that, by the way. Every single mom and dad has already blamed themselves. They've already done it. Every single family, when I say, what is your burning question? What is the question that you've been dying to ask somebody? No holds barred. Just give me your question. What's your burning question? They'll say, like, my mom told me that it's because I ate the thing and took the thing. And every single time when I look at that parent, I go like this, no. It doesn't even merit airtime other than the word no. So if a family tomorrow says, I took acetaminophen like 5 times in the first trimester, I'm so worried that that's what caused it. Dr. Tran, what do you think? I'm going to do exactly the same thing. No. And so we are ready as a society, we're ready as a specialist in this field across the board to absolutely say there's zero merit in blaming yourself.
Absolutely, 100% agree. Now what? What are parents supposed to make of all this, and what are they supposed to do?
I believe my patients are smarter than the administration right now. I believe they have already been engaged with science in a smart way. Because they've been engaged with their healthcare providers and all their trusted healthcare professionals along the way. I believe that's why, after the press conference, remember, I have a majority neurodevelopmental disabilities population, and we got like 5 questions. Because I believe we've been educating the families along the way. And so I worried that we would have this onslaught, but we did not. And so it tells me that our patients have already been engaging in a smart way. And those families who have doubts, I hope you have a trusted healthcare provider, physician, or a professional that you can ask your questions in an open and honest manner so you can have an open and honest conversation that feels without judgment. And if you don't have that, please find someone. And so you should be able to have that open and honest discussion in a non-judgmental way with folks who know what they're doing.
Thank you, Dr. Nguyen Tran, a developmental behavioral pediatrician in Austin, Texas. This episode of Petri Dish was produced by Jacob Rosati, TBR Vice President of News, Dan Katz, and me. Jacob Rosati also composed all the music, created the sound design, and edited the script. Yvette Benavides edited the story at TBR.org. Petri Dish is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Bonnie Petri. Talk to you soon.